You're listening to the COVID-19 Update, a podcast from the CSIS Global Health Policy Center focused on the science and policy implications of the outbreak. I'm Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm joined by my colleague, Steve Morrison, to discuss the latest on COVID-19.
So we're delighted today to be joined again by Dan Diamond, the national health reporter for the Washington Post. Dan, thank you for making the time today, and congratulations on the string of really great reporting on monkeypox, and among other things, that's going to be the subject of our discussion today. Thanks so much for making the time.
Steve, I'm so glad to be back. It's always really enjoyable and thought-provoking to talk to you. You give me new ideas for stories every time we speak.
Well, thank you. So this has been a hell of a busy week, right? We've got case counts in the United States of monkeypox over 5,000. We've got accelerated vaccine deliveries. We've got Tedros talking about this after the declaration of the global public health emergency of international concern last Saturday. He comes out with some very specific advice about men who are having sex with men, limiting their partners and tracking their partners. Fauci speaking about get serious and avoid stigmatizing. LGBTQ community in America mobilizing. San Francisco and New York City declaring emergencies, and all the big debate about where's the money and how much do we need, et cetera. It's just been a huge week. So why don't we start at the top of this with just give us your quick reflections on what's been happening.
I'd be remiss if I didn't say it felt very early 2020 COVID-ish, and that the situation is changing rapidly. Officials are rushing to catch up to a virus that they don't seem to have control over. The funding issue that you mentioned, Steve, we have reported earlier this week, my colleague Tony Rahm and I, that the internal estimates for a full-fledged monkeypox response would be about $7 billion. A middle-of-the-road response, assuming the virus stays in the gay and bisexual community, would be about $2 billion. Then there was a bare-bones response of $500 million. And it reminded me, I think I was the reporter back in early 2020 who broke the news of the first COVID supplemental and trying to wheedle that information out of the Trump administration, and just how unconcerned they seem to be. I remember some White House officials saying, you know, Alex Azar, the health secretary at the time, Alex Azar may have his wish list, but that doesn't mean we're gonna go along with it. And in retrospect, it looks so stupid. It was such a small amount of money that was initially carved out. So this White House is ahead of, in many ways, what the last White House was doing on COVID. But there are some similarities, I feel, in the testing and the messaging, even in some of the supplies and vaccines. So that's been going through my head over and over again. Understanding that monkeypox is not COVID. It doesn't kill like COVID. We know what it is. But man, it would be awful if it gets a foothold here permanently like COVID seems set to do.
Let's unpack that. Let's start with a bit of a retrospective. The first case in the U.S. was May 18th, I think, and we had delays in getting the testing moving. We had delays in accelerating vaccines. Data collection has been very, very weak. And on the face of it, you'd think that this would have been a home run. This is a disease that's known. It's understood. It's one where we have the tools. To some degree, we have the tools. We know the communities. The LGBTQ community, men who having sex with men, transgender people that we know who are most vulnerable. These are the populations that have been mobilized around HIV, where there's an entire leadership and healthy behavior and infrastructure to serve them. What went wrong, do you think? How did we wind up stumbling in that period? How do you account for that?
I feel like you're assigning me a story, so I'll offer my thoughts, but I very much want to hear yours, too. I've asked this question of virtually everyone, Steve. Why did this happen? Why did something that was described to me by some officials as like easy COVID, because of all the ways that we should know how to fight it, how did it get to a point that as of Friday morning, there are about 5,000 cases in the U.S., far and away biggest monkeypox outbreak here ever, and then certainly in dozens of other countries, monkeypox outbreaks multiplying as well. I think the superficial answer is we got unlucky on the timing and the population. Timing-wise, you have to think about the health departments, the epidemiologists, the infectious disease physicians, the federal officials, and so on, who are 2 years into COVID. They're worn down. People have quit. They haven't been replaced. This is just my theory, But I feel like this spring was a particularly low ebb and a time of transition after Omicron stressed all the systems in public health last winter. So there might have been folks who hung on to their jobs and said, well, I'll stay through Omicron, but then there was turnover after. So things have moved slower than they should have, in part because the energy and capacity wasn't quite there. I think that's on the provider and official side. And then on the patient side, monkeypox appeared to have gotten to the gay and bisexual community in Europe first this spring, with the strong possibility that several big parties that people traveled to from around the world were super spreader events. And we know monkeypox can spread by just skin-to-skin contact. Maybe you're dancing up and down in a rave. Maybe you're having a sexual liaison. So it just seems like absolute bad luck that this virus found its way into a population that had elevated risk of spreading it. And that was before June arrived, which was Pride Month for the gay community in the U.S. and at a moment when gay men were especially ready to throw parties after 2 years of being cooped up. So the calendar was not our friend. I could probably also give you specific answers blow by blow about decisions the administration has made on testing and vaccines, which we've covered at the Post and others have written about too. But why don't I stop? I'm curious what you're thinking here.
Well, I think you've hit some of the big points. I think the exhaustion, the overload, the depletion of health capacity was a terribly important factor. I think the money stalemate, the COVID money stalemate, had a hangover impact, was paralyzing in trying to think through creatively, what are the resources that we need? The administration's been able to draw on some emergency funding reserves, an account that Congressman Cole created for CDC to have. They've been able to do that, but they haven't been able to think and act big on money until just very recently. And I think that is a hangover effect of the paralysis and stalemate over getting money for the COVID response, where there's been a succession of stumbles and failures to work out some sort of consensus around what is now a proposal for $31.4 billion for the COVID response. So one failure beget another. I think that is a really important dimension. I think our political polarization and the politicization around COVID contributed to this in some ways. I think the memory of HIV and it also of stigma and discrimination led to a certain amount of timidity in the early phases in really speaking boldly and strongly and clearly about what was happening and what was at stake. So people were tiptoeing, it seems, around that. But I think the big elephant in the room is money, 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 and COVID, and the paralysis and exhaustion that we see. The other thing that was missing was leadership. The interagency became itself, I think, a victim of the money paralysis, but also there wasn't the kind of boldly stepping in to say, no, this time we're going to make sure this is really right. The interagency was left to sort of churn for 6 to 8 weeks in this period when there needed to be some bold action there.
I want to follow up on what you said. You made a couple of really interesting points. First, on the money. So do you fault the Republicans who are holding up the COVID money? They've said they need more information on the trillions of dollars that have already been spent. They're not convinced that all the previous COVID money has gone to good use. Not to say that Democrats don't have their own stumbles and why we don't have COVID money, but disproportionately, we don't have COVID funding because of Republicans. So do you blame Republicans in any way for the monkeypox spread that we're seeing?
I think there's plenty of blame to be spread. I mean, the paralysis and stalemate around COVID money, there's plenty of blame to be cast in the direction of Democrats and Republicans in Congress, as well as this White House. There simply has been no sufficient leadership to sort of come to a reckoning around these issues. And unfortunately, the electoral process and the polarization fuels that. And so, yes, I think we have to look at that as the major backdrop factor that has contributed to this lack of sufficient resources and a lack of leadership.
And when you talk about lack of leadership, you're talking about the interagency, so the different parts of the administration, HHS, White House, agencies working on monkeypox. Are you saying that, say, HHS Secretary Becerra has not been strong enough in grabbing hold of this?
I think the higher levels have needed to intervene at a very early point in order to make clear what the expectations were for speed and effectiveness in getting the testing out and available and the scale and speed needed, and to accelerate the delivery of the vaccines and get a plan in place. There still is no plan, and to fix the money problem so that that did not become the stumbling block. That required high-level leadership at the White House and at the level of secretary, and we simply have not seen that. I do think we're starting to see some progress this week, and I wanted to get your estimation. Is this progress going to correct course and put us on a path where we will avoid this becoming an entrenched disease? I realize that is a mega question and we don't have clear answers, but what is your thought thinking on that at this point?
Well, my thinking is that that's the right question to be asking. So I have been asking everybody and haven't gotten a sufficiently informative response. We had CDC Director Rochelle Walensky sit down with the Washington Post for a virtual interview a week ago. And I asked her specifically, did she have a red flag, a warning light that she was looking for on endemicity? Like, was there some level of cases? Was there something else where she would say we are in danger of monkeypox becoming permanently entrenched? And she challenged the question somewhat. And as the officials have done repeatedly, talked about our ability to still contain the virus and that we don't need to presume. So I don't know. I'm not an infectious disease scholar. I don't know what the clue would be if it's 20,000 cases, if it's picking it up in the rodent population of Washington, D.C. I mean, to me, that would be a monumental red flag. Like, once it gets into the animal reservoir, we're probably, you know, it's done. But I have not been able to get a sufficiently good answer as to where officials think we are, other than the window is small. It's closing some more. When it's slammed shut, no one is willing to say. But the more vaccine that is coming, the 800,000 doses that are now being allocated after being stuck overseas for some time, that would certainly be a good thing. The more testing that is coming online from the private laboratories, it took a little bit to get them up and running. That would also be a good thing. Interestingly, it reminds me so much of early COVID, just to hammer that point, where we relied on the public health labs there too. And didn't have a lot of testing at the beginning. This was somewhat different in that the public health labs kept saying, well, we've got all this capacity that isn't being used. I just think it's a bit of a breakdown, and people may not realize, especially if they're outside the gay and bisexual community, that they may have monkeypox. They may be going to doctors who aren't prepared to recognize their rash as monkeypox and being misdiagnosed. So I do feel like for all the advancements, and there are some good ones, there probably are many cases that we're just not tracking, and that's the risk of it getting into more populations.
Yes. So if it becomes entrenched, as you point out, we're going to see it becoming entrenched in animal reservoirs, and that we need to be tracking that. If it becomes entrenched, it's going to deepen within the LGBTQ community, but spread to other populations as well. We could be seeing more immunocompromised risk. We could see pregnant women and young newborns and young children. We could see it migrate into school systems, I would think, where there's skin-to-skin contact with children. We could see it migrate into sex workers, right? We could see it migrate into health providers, health workers. We could see it migrate into those who are in the hospitality business, who are changing sheets and towels in hotel rooms, right? Wouldn't those be the populations to be looking at this point and in the next 6 to 12 months to make some judgment about whether this is becoming endemic?
If you look at the places where monkeypox has been spreading before this outbreak in West and Central Africa, I believe all those populations had monkeypox cases confirmed. Kids in school, women who were not in the gay and bisexual community, people in the sex trade, people in hospitality. There have been also many anecdotal reports I've seen across social media in the past number of days. I don't know how real those are, but I saw one of a woman who claimed to have a friend who was a massage therapist who contracted monkeypox. Again, don't know if that was real or not. I was trying to run that down. But it does speak to, there are probably populations that are being affected by this outbreak that just don't know to test for it, or are going to the doctors and being told, well, you're not gay or bisexual. You've never been to a dance party with gay men. You didn't go to a rave in Europe. It does remind me of COVID. Again, the community spread that is starting to be picked up. I do want to go back to one thing you said, though, about the schools and the risk there. That has been absolutely on my mind, Steve. If this virus spreads skin to skin, there are kids who play with the same toys and roll around, you know, like it, that I feel like is the nightmare scenario. No knock to the poor people who are suffering from monkeypox right now, but a school outbreak, I mean, man. And I have had challenges trying to explain to conservative commentators in recent days who keep saying there's too much being made about monkeypox. This is a quote unquote gay disease. Well, it may be spreading in the gay and bisexual community, and we do need explicit warnings to make sure that people in that population are taking the right precautions, not engaging in risky behaviors. But the big kahuna, the big problem, is making sure that it doesn't end up spilling over into those populations of kids, pregnant women, and other vulnerable groups. And that's what is keeping me up at night on this story.
Now, two things on testing. Okay, we've moved to the five commercial firms that are now doing tests. So we're expanding the availability of tests. Are we beginning to close the gap on data? Because the testing was woeful in the early phase. The contracts with those five firms were wrapped up, I think, June 22nd. So they're coming online now. But we've had a paucity, a serious paucity of data on the demographics of those who are getting sick, the progression on the clinical data. And so getting visibility into what is happening and where it's spreading and that sort of thing requires a quantum leap in the quality and the reach of our data collection. What's your judgment on where we are in that process?
We are still far behind where we need to be. I was on a press call yesterday with HHS Secretary Becerra, the ASPR leader Don O'Connell, CDC officials, FDA, and there was some data shared, and I seem to recall, I don't have the transcript in front of me, but the caveat, as usual, you know, this is the data that we're working off of. We don't have the complete picture because not every case is being reported down to the demographics. I thought it was very interesting, Steve. I don't know if you saw this. I've been so busy, I've barely gone beyond the headline, but Senator Mitt Romney pushing for a new center to collect data. Did you see this week?
Yeah.
And I just thought that was interesting. Again, haven't had a chance to talk to the senator's office or really anybody about it, but it just reminded me of yet another attempt to layer over a problem that we know exists. We know that CDC has had data problems on COVID, on monkeypox, just in general, being able to get fast, quick, accurate data. So rather than propose a way to make that happen, Senator Romney and perhaps some other folks in Congress just want to layer over CDC and come up with another agency. And that to me speaks to, we have some problem that despite all the spotlight of COVID, we have not been able to address with getting the right data at the right time.
Yeah, I agree with you that we don't need to bypass CDC. We need to strengthen CDC. On the data question, I mean, my fear is that we just are still very limited visibility into what's going on within this country. And that leaves us a bit blinded to what may be a set of outbreaks that we're only going to become cognizant of in another 3 or 4 weeks. And we know there's a lot of people who have mild symptoms and it goes unreported as a case. And we know that there's a long gestation period of this, and you can remain contagious for up to a month in that period. So the progression of the disease is one that could lead to spread that we're not really catching. And we're not being aggressive enough. I want to shift a little bit. You want to say something on that, Dan?
Just two quick thoughts on that. So first, this idea that in some ways monkeypox is harder than COVID because of that incubation period that can be up to 3 weeks, that again, the population fell into gay and bisexual men who may have multiple sexual partners, who may have traveled to go to parties across the world or across the U.S., it just has gotten into a population that seemed more likely to spread it. And again, may not know that they're spreading it because of how long the virus can incubate and how it can present. And then also this idea of where we are on the data. I was emailing with Trevor Bedford, the quite intelligent, quite perceptive. I believe he's an official genius now from the MacArthur Foundation. So always good to hear his insight. And he was making a point as he studies the growth in cases that in the U.S., the doubling time for total cases has been essentially about a week, maybe 8 days. Every 8 days, we've seen the total number of cases double. And I think if you look at the numbers, we had, as of last Thursday, 2,300 cases. As of this Thursday, 4,600 cases. It does bear out. Whereas in other countries, the rate has slowed significantly. The doubling rate has gone to, say, 15 days or 20 days. And that, to me, Steve, suggests that we are still in the process of getting our testing up and running. And some of the cases that are being detected may just be better testing and finally being able to corroborate our spread, whereas other countries, particularly ones with national health systems, may have done a better job of getting their numbers under control before we did.
Yeah, well, Portugal is one very notable case of a country that's really swung into gear fast and effectively and has controlled this. So there are instances, there are comparative instances where we can look and say, well, how come we got that outcome there? On the vaccine, we have, you know, another 800,000 arriving this week. We're up to about 1.1, 1.2 million. The requirement to do a two-dose regimen for the 1.6 million people living with HIV, just that population, right, which is a very important population, that it be served fully, would require 3.2 million doses to have full coverage of the 1.6 million people living with HIV in this country. We're not going to have, until year's end, 2 million doses. So already, when you look mathematically at what the requirements are, we're facing some tough sledding here in the balance of this year. And we also have not settled on a strategy, it seems to me. I wanted you to comment. Is our strategy to try to identify, isolate, ring vaccinate? Is that the control strategy, or are we drifting into mass vaccination strategy? Because if we're drifting into mass vaccination, that's going to require huge volumes. It's also going to mean that we consume most of the world's supply of vaccines, potentially. What do you say about that? Are we heading into having far too few vaccines as against demand? And do we know what our strategy is?
Oh, such great questions, and ones I've been thinking about this week, too. So first, just to make sure that you and I and listeners are all on the same page, when you talk about ring vaccination, you're talking about the strategy of you find the person who has the virus, and then you go find all the people that that person has interacted with. So rather than vaccinate the entire city block, you're vaccinating the 8 people on the block who interacted with that person. And that way you're maximizing vaccine doses. So my understanding is that while that might have been the initial approach with monkeypox, it's not working, partly because if you're having sex partners that you don't know their names and you met them at a club, like, there's no way to put them in the ring. Like, you can't tell contact tracers who that person was with any ease. Or maybe you danced on a dance floor surrounded by a crowd of people and you don't know the names of those people. So I think the ship may have sailed on ring vaccination, which is too bad. As you point out, the population of people who could use the vaccine is bigger than the amount of vaccine we've got. So I think that's why we're already seeing a shift in New York City and Washington, D.C., to try and maximize the vaccine doses by saying, okay, we're going to just give as many first doses out now, and we'll worry about the second dose later. And I've been talking to folks this week about, you know, do we use this other vaccine, not Jynneos, the only vaccine approved for monkeypox? Do we use this older ACAM 2000 vaccine, which carries its own risks and isn't monkeypox approved? So I think they're trying to figure that out. But it does increasingly feel like we are moving to the mass vaccination strategy, which, again, we don't have doses for. And it also signals something about where we are in the outbreak if we need to do mass vaccinations.
Right. So that gets to my next question, which is, if we assume that we're going to move towards, for vaccines in a volume, to do large-scale vaccinations, and we know that Jynneos, which is the best vaccine, is not going to be available in the volume we need as quickly as we need. We do know that there is bulk, that the U.S. owns bulk volume for vaccines, that they're trying to bring to the United States that bulk material and get other commercial firms to fill and finish the vaccines. They're scrambling to see what could be done there that might bring us another 15 million doses or something like that, which would be very important. One question there, can that be done with the speed? Do we know? Can that be done with the speed to meet demand? And an alternative is, if we get ourselves into a big crunch in the fall, where the demand, we know what the demand is, we have better visibility into what's going on, but we Genios can't meet the demand, do we turn to ACAM 2000?
These are such great timely questions. I've been wondering all these things too. I think with the fill and finish of the doses that have yet to be manufactured from Genios, my understanding is it's about 11 million, which is still considerably more than we have on hand, but that would still be months away in the production, even if the U.S. is working with the manufacturer, Bavarian Nordic, set up a plant and find a partner, that we're still many months away. Certainly nothing that could be turned around by this fall. And then I think in terms of ACAM 2000, this is a vaccine that is not explicitly approved for monkeypox. It's approved for smallpox, related orthopox virus. It is administered differently. You can be jabbed so many times that it draws blood. There are folks who don't want to get that vaccine. It also relies on a live virus, vaccinia virus, that can lead to infections in people who get it and it's not perfectly administered or contained. So there are lots of reasons why federal officials have not wanted to go down that route. And I do worry, Steve, that it's just going to create really difficult messaging if we need to convince more Americans, especially outside the gay community, to get inoculated against monkeypox. We're already dealing with some messaging challenges around what is this disease, who's at risk. And to say, oh, and we've run out of the only vaccine that's approved for monkeypox, it just reminds me of some of the challenges with COVID and the skepticism that emerged then.
We've had a global declaration of an emergency by Dr. Tedros of WHO last Saturday. We've had San Francisco and New York State declare public health emergencies. The administration's been debating pretty fiercely internally this week as to whether it should, as a national matter, declare a public health emergency. There are calls for a variety of other situations to be declared emergencies. Tell us your insights, Dan, as to what is fueling the debate, what are the considerations, and does it matter whether at this point whether we have a declaration of that kind?
Steve, I had a story that went up Monday, I want to say mid-morning or middle of the day, on the internal debate over the public health emergency. And it's true. After the WHO declared its FIKE, its public health emergency of international concern, that kicked into gear conversations that have been going in the administration for a while. And the debate was, do we follow that? Do we replicate WHO here? Sometimes that happens with COVID. Sometimes it hasn't happened, like with polio, when the World Health Organization said that was a global public health emergency and there was no reason to declare it here. Obviously, monkeypox is spreading significantly. But my understanding as of Monday, and as we were talking as of Friday morning, no decision has been made. There have been some reports that a decision was likely even this week. I don't believe that to be the case. It's possible this podcast will go up and I'll look like a big dummy. But my understanding is the considerations remain, one, what does a PHE actually allow us to do? Does it make enough of a difference on the data collection? Some have said, well, yes, it does, but there also are ways we can work around some of this. Does it make a difference on the FDA using emergency use authorizations? Well, yes, it does. How much of that do we need at this point for treatments like TPOXX, the antiviral that's kept in the Strategic National Stockpile? There's been some debate over, can things be loosened enough without an EUA? And then there are other efforts afoot to maybe use a public health emergency to better reimburse providers or do the things we saw in COVID, essentially, make things more flexible. But you're also right, these political considerations are real. There are advocates who have clamored for weeks that abortion needs to be a public health emergency because after the Dobbs decision, restrictions began to take effect across the country, hard to get abortions in many places. There probably are real pains, maybe even death associated with women who are struggling now to get reproductive health care. So there are advocates who have said, we desperately need this PHE for abortion. And if one comes for monkeypox, I think the White House is in a bit of a domestic political bind as to why they're making one an emergency and not the other. And that's not even mentioning the effort on gun violence or climate change to make those national emergencies too. So I think this is an active conversation. It would not surprise me if this happens. There are people in HHS especially who want it, but there are others in HHS in the White House who are being pretty cautious here.
Globally, let's talk about the global situation, right? We know that this is endemic in West and Central Africa. We know that there's really scant data coming forward from those regions. That's something that Dr. Tedros acknowledged when he called together the emergency committee at WHO, met end of last week, and then he made the declaration on Saturday about the public health emergency of international concern. We know that we're dealing with scant data, but we also know that demand for the tools in those countries in Africa, as well as other countries, it's now in 78 countries, I believe, in the world, that we're going to have equity concerns and access concerns around vaccines, tests, and therapies, ultimately. And we don't at the moment have anything approximating a global plan or any kind of coordinated consensus around what is going to happen. What are your thoughts on the global situation and what lies ahead?
I have been pondering this increasingly because I tried to cover COVID globally, and it feels, again, very similar. There has been a story I've heard again and again from monkeypox patients, people who are trying to get tests, trying to get vaccines, and are working their connections to do so because they're just running into bureaucracy or limited supply. And over again, it's the people who have help that can get what they need on monkeypox. And then there are plenty of people, as my colleague Fenton Nirupal wrote, who don't have those advantages and are being turned away, and they're suffering with monkeypox and no treatment like TPOX for days on end. I think about that because globally, the U.S., we're the well-off patients. We're the ones with the help and the access. And so many others are going to be the patients without advantages. I think there is a high chance we will see, as we saw with COVID, big global inequity. The argument that the U.S. needs to move aggressively is that we now have the largest outbreak in the world. Maybe that's because we're testing the most and we have the best data on it now. But that would be the counter, that the reason we need more vaccine, more treatments, is because our problem is that much bigger than other countries. I mean, at this point, we have about 5,000 confirmed cases. Again, there may be thousands of additional ones we don't know about. And then there are other countries where the numbers are much, much lower, you know, in the dozens, though there may be a lot of cases that aren't being picked up. This is my roundabout way of saying it's knotty. It is a knotty problem. And I do think we're heading for another U.S. has advantages and other countries don't situation.
Yes. I do think there may be a silver lining in this in the sense that Bavarian Nordic developed its very good vaccine through U.S. support, through BARDA, for the national stockpile. And we struck that relationship in the mid-naught decade, and it's evolved, and we should be proud of what we did because we developed a safer, more effective smallpox vaccine. And lo and behold, it turned out to be safe and effective for monkeypox. And we are now taking steps to massively expand the production capacity for that vaccine. And if we overshoot deliberately, we could be in a leadership position globally in order to meet rising demand coming from wherever. And we could be generous. We could be generous and strategic in this next phase. Your thoughts?
Completely agree. I think the Bavarian Nordic story is very interesting. If I had more time, I'd be running that down. I went back and watched some comments that the CEO, I believe his name is Paul Chaplin, made about the partnership with the U.S. government. This was pre-COVID, pre-monkeypox, but talking about the success of that partnership and growing Bavarian Nordic. So yes, this is a company that owes a lot to U.S. investment, overwhelmingly to U.S. investment. And now they are the company poised to deliver vaccines to the world on monkeypox. It's a fascinating story and speaks to, for all the screw-ups over the past couple of years, there are plenty of things that the U.S. government does get right. This appears to be one of them.
Yes. So that's a positive note. I'm glad we're ending on a positive note here. And like all of our podcasts, we close by asking our guest to tell us what gives you in this situation the greatest optimism and hope.
About monkeypox?
Yeah. What
the greatest optimism and hope. You have not been on my calls this week where everyone is complaining to me about all the problems we have. Greatest optimism and hope. I would say that the fact that monkeypox has yet to lead to a single confirmed U.S. death, I know it's still early. I know it is predominantly in the male adult population, people who are probably pretty healthy in comparison to, say, folks in nursing homes or kids. But man, it would be really, really good if, unlike COVID, we're not talking about all the people lost to monkeypox. That's not to minimize the pain and suffering. It sounds awful. And we do not want this virus here. But I would like to cover a virus, Steve, where I'm not also covering the obituaries. So that's my hope.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Dan, for taking the time to be with us today. And thanks for all your great work. You've really done remarkable reporting in this period, as you've done, as you've been doing on COVID throughout. And we're really grateful to you and for also for taking the time to be with us today.
I will reiterate what I said at the top. I really enjoy talking to you, Steve. You ask such great questions and you're provocative in your thinking. So thanks for having me back.
Coronavirus Crisis Update is produced by Laurel Vibazon and managed by Claire Dannenbaum. You can find our full catalog of podcasts, including Pandemic Planet and AIDS Existential Moment, on our homepage at csis.org/podcasts.